Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today we'll talk about the reluctant and uneasy alliance between the United States and Pakistan. My guest today has likened the American-Pakistani relationship to a failed romance where neither partner can quite decide to break it off. In fact, in the current issue of Foreign Affairs, Ambassador Hussein Haqqani, the former Pakistani ambassador to the United States, writes that breaking up is not hard to do, the title of the article. Writes that it's impossible to be allies when over 90% of the Pakistani public think of the United States as an enemy. Three-quarters of Americans feel the same way about Pakistan. Hussein Haqqani is currently a professor of international relations at Boston University and the director of their Center of International Relations, and a senior fellow and director for South and Central Asia at the Hudson Institute. He was ambassador of Pakistan to the United States from 2008 to 2011. To give you a sense of the uneasy relationship between these two countries, his ambassadorship ended when he was accused of treason for being too pro-American. Well, he'll be giving a free public lecture at the University of Tulsa tonight in the Lorton Performance Center at 7:30. The title of his lecture is Pakistan and the U.S., Future of a Reluctant Alliance That's Free and Open to the Public. And Ambassador Haqqani joins us today on Studio Tulsa. Ambassador Haqqani, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining. It's been some years, but we're happy to have you back.
It's a pleasure being back. Tulsa's a great city, and it's great to be here again.
Now, since you were last here, you had a stint as the Pakistani ambassador to the United States. We'll talk about how that concluded, because it gives us a sense of the unsettling nature of Pakistani politics. But first, let's talk a little bit about this recent article, which is just out in Foreign Affairs. In some ways, you liken the U.S.-Pakistani relationship to a dysfunctional romance where both partners are somewhat frustrated, but they just can't say, let's break up. And the name of the article is Breaking Up is Not Hard to Do. And this sort of symbolizes our relationship with the Pakistanis.
Well, the fact is that most Americans do not know the history of Pakistan's origins. And most Pakistanis did not know much about the United States when Pakistan was created in 1947. Pakistan, as you know, was carved out of India for the Muslims of India. And then Pakistan itself went through a partition in 1971, and what is today Bangladesh broke out of Pakistan. So Pakistan's biggest concern has always been to try and avoid what Pakistanis call dismemberment or breaking up. And their biggest concern in that has been an aversion to what they deem to be Indian dominance. So when Pakistan approached the United States way back in 1947 that we want to be your allies, American concerns at that time were about global communism. Pakistan's concern was about India. And it was a bit of a mismatch to begin with. Over the years, there were American officials who thought, you know what, why don't we take advantage of the situation? This country is willing to be our frontline state. Let's use them.
And also, India at the time would run hot and cold on the United States and sort of played off both the United States and the USSR.
India's view was, we are a poor country. We want to develop ourselves. We don't care whether we get the machinery from Russia or whether we get it from America. Americans didn't like that. Their offer was, you know, either you are with us or against us. And India said, no, we are not against you, but we don't want to be with you. We want to be non-aligned. And that didn't sit well with America. And Pakistan was this eager sort of new country created for the first time as a country, very eager to become an ally. So everybody embraced it, although some people were reluctant and said, why are we getting into this?
I learned something from one of your articles. I had never realized that about a third of the old territorial army came from Pakistan.
Oh, yes. The British Indian Army, which the British had raised for the Second World War.
Mainly from Pakistan.
Geographically, their origins lay in what is today Pakistan. So when the division of the country, of British India, came and Pakistan was created as a separate country, Pakistan ended up with one-third of the old empire's army, but only 17% of the old empire's revenue sources. So they had a bigger army, which they needed to feed, which we needed to pay for. And many of our leaders at that time thought America is the ticket to retain the army, keep it well equipped, and pay for it.
In some sense, it provides a sense of stability, but it also provides a sense of instability because you don't have that strong economic engine.
No country in the world has ever been, and I will say this to Americans because they need to think about it about their own country, no country can be a major power in the world and have a huge military and have huge military prowess without an economy to back it. And in case of Pakistan, American assistance became a substitute for developing a strong domestic economy. And Pakistan and the United States have been allies thrice, in the Cold War, in the early part of the Cold War, then against the, in the war against the Soviets in Afghanistan, when Pakistan was used as the base for training the Mujahideen, as they were called. Many people may have seen the movie Charlie Wilson's War. Yeah. It's not historically completely accurate, glorifies a particular congressman too much. But that notwithstanding, gives a good picture of what was happening. America was training these Mujahideen who were meant to fight the Soviets, but their control lay with the Pakistani intelligence. And Pakistani intelligence was thinking this is our opportunity to create what they called strategic depth in Afghanistan. We will have a bigger base in Afghanistan after the Soviets leave with American assistance, and that base will help us run operations against India, which did happen, except that the Americans lost interest in 1989 once the Soviets left Afghanistan and the Soviet Union started breaking up. So America kind of lost interest in Afghanistan, and Pakistan tried to fill the vacuum without the economic resources, and they ended up helping the Taliban come to power. Until 9/11, when Pakistan became an ally again, this time against terrorism, which to a large extent had evolved within Pakistan, partly with support of certain Pakistani leaders, and partly just because the state and the government of Pakistan do not have the resources and the means to control all parts of the country equally.
And this is where we find ourselves today. We've been, again, pouring money into Pakistan. And from an American perspective, we see a lot of money going there. We don't see a lot of cooperation early on in the post-9/11 conflict in Afghanistan. Certainly since the drone strikes have started happening on the Pakistani side of the border, obviously they're not going to, you know, that's going to make the relationship worse. Finding Osama bin Laden in Pakistani territory, in the place he was found.
Well, the fact is that 92% of Pakistanis have an unfavorable view of the United States, and 74% of Americans have an unfavorable view of Pakistan. Pakistan ranks along with Iran and North Korea, who are not America's allies, as the least favored nations among American people in public opinion polling. Now, I don't expect you to remember, because you've interviewed hundreds of people, maybe thousands since then, but the last time I was in your studio 10 years ago, we discussed the American alliance, and this was 2003. There was still the romance, you know. This time around, Pakistan.
We're going to get it right.
Yeah, and I said to you, you know, this is the problem. General Musharraf cannot be trusted because his purpose is to keep himself in power and to keep the Pakistani military strong in relation to India. And he will do what he needs to do to continue to get American assistance, but he will not finish the job. And now that we have history behind us, you will probably agree that that was the correct analysis. And right now, my analysis says that it is in America's interest and in Pakistan's interest. Pakistan as in the people of Pakistan. I am a Pakistani, so I think about the people of Pakistan. It's in Pakistan's interest for this alliance to kind of take a step back. And then Pakistan needs to reevaluate what is its raison d'etre, what's its purpose, what does it want. And similarly, they need to evaluate why, for example, $40 billion of American assistance since 1947 has not made Pakistan the kind of economic power that only $8 billion of assistance helped transform Taiwan, or $15 billion helped make South Korea what it is today. Why couldn't Pakistan do it? Pakistan needs some time to reflect on that. If the aid keeps on flowing uninterrupted, that reflection will not take place in Pakistan.
How much of that raison d'etre that you spoke about Pakistan, is really geared towards being antagonistic to India, or opposing Indian interests, or applying their interests to the, you know, a zero-sum game with India?
Absolutely. Look, first of all, let's understand one basic principle of international relations. All nations need to put their security first, and they need to evaluate their security in a realistic manner. So when Pakistan was created, it was realistic of Pakistanis to think that because we've been carved out of India,
that India would want it back.
That India would want it back. That was a reasonable assertion at that time. It's not reasonable 66 years later. It's a bit like the United States and Canada. I don't know how many Americans now remember, by the way, my experience is that American high schools, the way they teach history, boy, I mean, day before yesterday, I was teaching a class in Boston where I now teach, and I was absolutely surprised when two-thirds of my class didn't know who Andrew Jackson was. Here's a guy who grew up in Pakistan, has worked outside of the United States for most of his life, is now in the United States teaching. I know American history a little bit better than my students who've come from high school, and they should have known all of this. But anyway, so a lot of people don't know and remember that America actually wars with Canada. America and the Mexican-American War is difficult for people to forget, yes. So I hope they mm-hmm. remember that. But guess what? They moved on. They've understood, Canada understood that we can't keep sort of fighting America, and Mexico realizes that it has better opportunities of working cooperatively with the United States. So you put your conflict sometimes behind you and move on. In case of Pakistan, because the military assumed political power, and we had four military coups and generals became presidents, and they thought very simplistically, they ended up enforcing or reinforcing the view of India as a permanent enemy. My view as a Pakistani is that no nation can afford to cast any other nation as a permanent enemy. But because they think India is a permanent enemy, therefore their great goal is to try and make Pakistan India's military equal. And if it can't be equal in a conventional sense, then Pakistan wants to pursue nuclear weapons or have a subconventional capability. Subconventional capability includes terrorism, and that is what is destabilizing that entire region.
Or a destabilization of a country like Afghanistan, keep it weak so that it can't ally itself with any of Pakistan's neighbors.
Absolutely.
So it is in Pakistan's interest to have a very weak, divided Afghanistan, not a big nation-building effort in that country.
It's in the interest of those who think that Pakistan yes. has a permanent dispute with India and needs to control Afghanistan. But those of us, and we are all Pakistanis too, there are two opinions in Pakistan. Many of us think, you know what, it would be in Pakistan's greater interest to sit at the crossroads. If you look at the map, you realize, where is Pakistan sitting? Pakistan is sitting at the crossroads of opportunity of trade between the Middle East and India, between China and the Middle East, and between the Central Asian republics of the former Soviet Union, the Stans as they are called, mm-hmm. and India. And so we could actually benefit economically by having closer relations with Afghanistan, closer relations with India, opening the trade routes instead of worrying about India aligning with Afghanistan and therefore squeezing Pakistan. But that's not how we, our leaders at the moment are thinking. And as a result, we keep getting involved in Afghanistan in a way in which it is detrimental to American interests and intentionally or unintentionally helps create a terrorist safe haven in the border areas of Pakistan and Afghanistan.
And I would think it would limit development in those border areas of Pakistan by having that instability.
Oh, not only that, those areas do not become fully integrated into Pakistan, because if you're going to create, if you're going to have an area of your country where you do not want things to be according to the rules that the rest of the country is run by, then you will allow a degree of lawlessness. The Mujahideen, the Jihadis, the terrorists, whatever you call them, the Taliban, they follow their own rules. Secondly, if they ever become powerful or more powerful in Afghanistan or in the border areas of Pakistan again, they have a belief system. They won't stop there. They would want that belief system to then spill over into Pakistan.
You can see the south part of Pakistan, those secularists, we need to send our version of what law is to their areas.
And basically they are coming down because, after all, this is a belief system. And,
yes.
And you know, a lot of people, and I am sure that a lot of people who are listening to this conversation are people of belief. People of belief often want other people to come around to their beliefs. And so if the people of belief believe that they have the right to use force to get people to believe like they do, then they will not restrict it to Afghanistan. They would want their belief to spread in Pakistan. And that is a major, major security challenge for Pakistan itself. I mean, the Taliban will end up posing a threat to Pakistan, even though many of Pakistan's military leaders, in particular like General Musharraf and his successors, think that the Taliban are allies of Pakistan, ensuring Pakistan's power equality with India.
I would think that the Taliban leaders are using Pakistan's leadership the same way Pakistan leadership's using the Taliban and groups like that.
Absolutely.
I mean, they don't have mutual interests. They just have a mutual enemy, if you will.
And that is a bit similar to what happened in the U.S.-Pakistan relationship, which is why I say, let us not get carried away by the romance of a relationship. Let's be realistic. What is possible and what is not? And Pakistan and the United States cannot be allies without being friends. And so we need to build the friendship first. We need to convince the American people, the Pakistanis need to convince the American people that bin Laden being found in Pakistan and things like that do not represent an inherent animosity on the part of Pakistan towards the United States. It will take time. I mean, I fully understand people in America are not accepting that. Why did this country have bin Laden there and still claims to be our ally? And then the Americans have to win over the Pakistanis. What has been happening for the last 66 years is a very complex dance, a kabuki dance, if you want to call it that, in which Pakistan is not a friend, but is an ally. And that is not the way the world really works. America is better off having allies that are also favorably disposed to the U.S. You can't be enemy and ally at the same time, or adversary and ally, or you can't be a country that is defiant. So Pakistan can't kind of, somebody asked me and I said, it's a bit like Pakistan can't behave like Iran and expect to be treated like Israel.
My guest today is Ambassador Hussein Haqqani. He was the Pakistani ambassador in the United States from 2008 to 2011. He's currently teaching at Boston University and a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute. He'll be speaking tonight at 7:30 in the Lorton Performance Center, talking about the future of the Reluctant Alliance of Pakistan and the United States. It's a free lecture tonight at 7:30 here on the TU campus, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. I was struck by something you said earlier, which you said, from Pakistan's very beginning, it has really felt the idea that India would want to reclaim that part of old imperial British India. I'm wondering how the loss of East Pakistan, Bangladesh, has figured in that thought, even though from the very beginning days of partition, everybody saw that having Pakistan on two sides of India with West and East was never going to work. And,
I mean, yeah, think about it. If Alaska had been at the other end of Russia, you know, and the United States has hostile relations with Russia, and you didn't have land access to it, and you didn't have any, you know, you had to overfly enemy territory to get to your own country, it would have been very different, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
It would have
been but how thing. Did the loss of Bangladesh affect the leadership in that feeling?
So the loss of Bangladesh should have made people in Pakistan think twice. A, Bangladesh went its own way because of internal Pakistani politics, not just because of a hostile India. Second, India did not reabsorb Bangladesh. India let Bangladesh be Bangladesh and be a new country. And that should have reduced the Pakistani fear that India wants to reclaim the old empire. Maybe India still thinks of the whole region as one integrated whole, but that would have taken the shape of some kind of a South Asian free trade agreement like NAFTA or something. It's not about taking over territory again, like Mexico. If it wants New Mexico and Arizona and California back, it's not going to happen. And so that reality should have dawned, but that didn't happen. What happened was that a lot of people, especially those who fought in Bangladesh, when they came back and served in the Pakistani military, they had this great desire to avenge the loss of Bangladesh. And that has been a factor in the thinking of some Pakistanis, at least.
Well, when you talk about the Pakistani leadership of needing to find a new raison d'etre, what is it going to take for them to realize, and maybe this will never happen, but the idea that, you know, opposition to India is not their raison d'etre?
Well, it'll take some time. I think it always happens within countries. The Soviet Union collapsed from within. America didn't land troops there. What happened was that the global situation was such that the Soviet Union was just not succeeding, and the cost of trying to succeed was causing tremendous difficulties for the Soviet people. And that's when the Soviet Union changed. Iran, I think, will go the same way eventually, when people realize that we can't maintain prosperity at home while pursuing some grand ideological design around the world. So Pakistan also, the good news is Pakistan has now kind of become a democracy. We've had elections. I served an elected government, General Musharraf, who took power in a military coup, is now back in the country trying to run for elections, although I don't think he will succeed much, but that in itself is a success, that now everybody has to try and win over public opinion. The process of winning public opinion also means that there is going to be a little bit more debate. So voices like mine will have to be heard. What is the purpose of our country? And I think that some people at least will raise their voice and say Pakistan's raison d'etre, its purpose should be the prosperity of its people. Look, let's look at statistics. 92% of school-going age children, children between the age of 5 and 15, go to school in India. 96% of the same age bracket go to school in Bangladesh. Only 58% go to school in Pakistan. School enrollment is very low. We are putting more money into our military than we are putting into our schools. And the nation is not gaining for that. India's economic growth is 7%, 6%, between 6 and 8% annually. Pakistan's economic growth is hovering at 2, 3, 4%. And Pakistan's population is growing as well. So it's not really, the prosperity is not increasing. Secondly, one third of Pakistan's population lives below the poverty line. Another one third lives just above it. So that's two thirds of the population living on less than $2 a day per household. That is not a sign of prosperity. You hear about terrorist incidents in Pakistan all the time. I mean, it's reached the point where it's so common that some newspaper editors tell me, well, we don't even run the story every day because the old definition of news, man bites dog is news, dog bites man is not. Yeah. It's become so common. There's a terrorist incident even today. Some bomb went off in one part of Pakistan and another. So you have too many militias, too many groups who continue to undermine Pakistan's own security. And when you don't have security, you don't have investment. When you don't have investment, you don't have prosperity. So that whole cycle and circle will force Pakistan to rethink its overall policy. But if America keeps giving bailouts, if when the economy is going south, there's a big, huge American economic package comes, aid package comes, then those who do not want to change can postpone and delay the change in Pakistan's raison d'etre and the debate about it forever and ever. And that's what's
happened. So really the billions has basically provided the impetus for Pakistan not to have to change.
Absolutely. I mean, Pakistan should have had the...
It just shores up the current situation well enough so that things don't become intolerable.
The reflection on what we should do as a nation inside Pakistan does not take place when America continues to feed our military and we don't have to have the guns versus butter debate among our own people.
The only thing, most militaries would look at an unstable Pakistan itself with all the terrorist incidents and say, this doesn't bode well for us if we can't control our own country. Is there any thought within the military about that?
I'm sure there is. I'm sure because our military is, like all militaries, is a patriotic military. It cares about Pakistan. I'm sure that they look upon it with some trepidation. But at the same time, one of the unfortunate parts of the deterioration in U.S.-Pakistan relations is that Pakistan has become a home of many, many conspiracy theories. So just go online and look at Pakistan and you will find a conspiracy theory for everything. 9/11 didn't happen the way the Americans say. Bin Laden wasn't actually in Pakistan. They brought his body and pretended that they had killed him. All that Americans want is to take away Pakistan's nukes. That's the only purpose the Americans want. We don't need to have American capital or investment for that very reason. So the whole conspiracy theory mania in Pakistani society also affects the thinking of Pakistan's military thinkers.
Who should know better?
Who should know better? But they're affected. I mean, as ambassador,
We're not immune to conspiracy theories here in the United States,
not,
as you were.
You're not, but it would be very rare. I mean, I doubt if you will actually end up having, say, a four-star general who really doesn't believe America went to the moon. I mean, that's going to be difficult, or that 9/11 didn't happen. So, in fact, most conspiracy theories about 9/11 online have originated within the United States, yeah. Unfortunately.
It's true.
You know, the theory being that the American government did it so that they could start wars, which is absolute and utter nonsense. But in Pakistan, a lot of people who should know better don't know better. So it'll take some time. But I think what the U.S. needs to do is to have a more pragmatic approach to the region and accept these things as given, accept them as reality. Don't live in denial. America shouldn't live in denial so that then Pakistan stops living in denial.
What does the United States, beyond just that idea of the aid propping up the status quo, What about all the, you know, the border incursions through drone strikes? You know, this used to be a violation of international law. I suppose it still is, but nobody talks about that.
Well, I mean, the problem is that America has decided to keep the drone program secret. That doesn't enable you to...
Worst secret in the world.
Yeah, you do not want to acknowledge it. You do not want to conduct an agreement with another country and have... And if you have an agreement, you don't want to reveal it. So are you really violating sovereignty if it's taking place with the approval of a foreign government? Does that approval exist? Who are you targeting? Unless you go public with that information, there will be all kinds of conspiracy theories and rumors about it. For example, the American authorities, in my opinion, justifiably so, maintain that the number of civilian casualties through drone strikes are a lot less than they would be if they were conventional airstrikes, because the drone has this Hellfire missile. It's very specific. It's very targeted. It's looking at it. It's basically a surveillance plane. It's taking pictures, and then it sees the right target, and it gets it. So the collateral damage is supposed to be much less. But if you're not going to reveal it, and you're not going to go public with it, then people will say hundreds and thousands of civilians are getting killed every day by the drones, and resentment against that will build up. So the advantage of killing the terrorists with drones is mitigated by the hostility that it creates, which then allows the terrorist groups to recruit more people. And last but not least, the problem that is created by thinking of an instrument as policy also needs to be understood. The drone is an instrument. It's not policy. You need a bigger policy. Donald Rumsfeld in 2002, soon after the beginning of operations in Afghanistan, said the biggest thing the Americans have to keep in mind is, are we killing the terrorists at a faster rate than their ranks are being replenished from the madrasas and from the extremist groups within the Islamic world? And that is a question Americans have stopped thinking about.
It's a little bit of a wrong question, because Pakistan, it's not so much killing more terrorists. It's killing more terrorists than that actually killing them causes new recruits.
Absolutely. There's no point in killing 20 people that you already know are terrorists if 200 more are going to become terrorists whose identities you won't even know until they've actually engaged in their first terrorist attack. And you and I haven't even spoken about the nuclear issue. Yeah. Pakistan is, of course, a proven nuclear power. It has tested nuclear weapons, and America has some concerns about Pakistan's nukes, and therefore it's in America's interest to engage Pakistan to make sure that there is no further proliferation of nuclear technology outside of Pakistan. And it's in Pakistan's interest to keep America informed that the kind of things that Dr. A.Q. Khan, who sold Pakistan's nuclear secrets to Iran and North Korea, that something like that is not happening. So all of those are important elements in this relationship, except that it all ends up becoming about economic aid, military aid, and about very limited objectives, and then creates those romantic expectations that I have started saying needs to be dispelled.
Yeah. And of course, the fear of an unstable nuclear Pakistan is also a big policy concern of the United States as
well. Absolutely. And it's a legitimate concern. It's also a concern of many Pakistanis.
Yeah. Ambassador Haqqani, thank you very much for joining us.
It was such a pleasure talking to you again.
Ambassador Hussein Haqqani was the ambassador of Pakistan to the United States from 2008 until 2011. He's currently teaching at Boston University and a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute. He'll be giving a lecture tonight at 7:30 at the University of Tulsa's Lorton Performance Center on Pakistan and the U.S., Future of a Reluctant Alliance. The lecture is free and open to the public. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.